Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be back here. We lived in the Thurber House attic for a summer in 1985, I think, and I wrote a part of my second novel there, so I'm very attached to Columbus in a variety of ways. And I had a good time when I was here in the snowstorm, though I was sorry to miss this event. Instead, I went out drinking. I'm going to read from a couple of places in this book. It's a book really about two women, two marriages. How to get them together, that was the problem. So I just had them move in side one, a couple move in next to the other in a double house. The older woman in this book is the wife of a philandering senator. As this book came out, Elliot Spitzer did his trick, and I'm sure that was enormously helpful to me, but such a man is the husband of Delia, and they've made a kind of accommodation around that. That is to say, they're separated, as far as everyone knows, amicably separated, but in fact, they see each other from time to time, and Delia is in charge of that in a way that she feels gives her some control over their lives together. And then Mary and her husband move in next door. Mary's husband's an academic, and this is a university town in New England. Delia's long since separated from Tom, and he's no longer a senator. And one of the reasons that Mary and her husband have moved in is that her husband, who's a political scientist, so admires the senator. They're sort of bemused and perplexed by his absence next door. They haven't quite figured it out yet at this point in the book. Mary is very attracted to Delia, very compelled by her, and they invite her for dinner. So this is the conversation over dinner, essentially, which involves a lot of the things that I was interested in thematically in this book. And there are a couple of things mentioned here. One is Delia's job. She's a docent at the home of a woman who has become famous posthumously for her writing, short stories in a novel that she wrote in the mid part of the 19th century. It's a home in this university town. And then Delia also mentions the woman who lived on the other side of the house, the double house, Ilona, at a certain point in this conversation. But otherwise, I think everything's pretty self-explanatory. This is their first meal together with Delia. When Mary answered the door, Delia sailed in. For the first time, Mary thought she understood that word as it would apply to a human being. She was carrying a huge spray of white lilies. While Nathan opened a bottle of wine in the living room, Mary got out the folding stepladder and looked through the high shelves in the pantry for a vase big enough for the flowers. Nothing. She finally had to put them in a galvanized bucket. They were so tall and full. Even in this homely container, though, they made the living room suddenly more finished-looking when she carried them in to where Delia and Nathan were sitting. She set them on the curved bench in front of the darkening windows. "They're gorgeous, Delia," she said, stepping back. "Thank you." "Well, the thing is, lilies last," Delia said. Mary looked over at her. Her wine glass was in her hand. Her legs were crossed. For a woman in her 70s, she looked absurdly glamorous, Mary thought. "And they're gorgeous," Nathan said. Mary sat down on the slightly sagging couch, which had come from her apartment in Coleman. Delia was in the wing chair from Nathan's mother. Nathan was in an old armchair of his. None of these things matched or even began to complement each other. They talked for a while about how they were settling in, and then Mary had to get up and go to the kitchen. She had to baste the pork roast, being careful not to let the one wobbly rack in the oven tip it onto the floor. Then she had to sauté the shallots for the green beans. She was in and out of the kitchen a good deal, actually, before the meal. It was too fancy, she realized, what she'd planned. It took her away too much. But she could tell that it was going well between Delia and Nathan. She could hear their voices quickly alternating, and Nathan's big laugh rang out often. Delia was charming him, just as she'd charmed Mary whenever their paths crossed. This was what being a senator's wife would do for you, Mary supposed, turn you into an almost professionally charming person. When Mary made her last appearance, Nathan was talking about his book. He was expansive under Delia's questioning, and Mary could hear pleasure in his voice. He'd messed his hair up, too. At dinner, Mary had her turn receiving Delia's energetic attention. She found herself explaining her work in almost as full detail as Nathan had his. Delia was a person who could say, "Fascinating," and make you feel suddenly that your life was. "Why didn't they have jobs like this when I was a young woman?" she asked at one point. Then she smiled. Not that it would have mattered, since I was not a young woman who ever even had a job, unless you count summer jobs in college. If that counts, I was a waitress for a combined total of perhaps 6 or 8 months of my life. They talked about their first jobs. Nathan had been a caddy in high school. Mary had worked as a receptionist at a seedy motel at the edge of her hometown. "And where was this?" Delia asked. "Rock Hill, Illinois," Mary said dismissively. "No one's ever heard of it." "No, you're right, I haven't either," Delia said. "But I don't know the Midwest well. Like so many Easterners, I suppose, all of us are really more or less snobs about the Midwest, I think." "But it works both ways," Nathan said. "Midwesterners don't know the East either. Mary'd never been East before she met me." "Not so," Mary said. "I was in New York once for about a week." "New York is not the East," Nathan said. "A world unto itself," Delia agreed, "as Washington is." "Well, and it was a class trip too," Mary said, remembering. "I was in a herd in New York," is what I should have said, "a herd of teenagers. And we did things I'd never do again. The Statue of Liberty, City Hall. Though I did like the boat cruise." She had made out through most of it with her boyfriend at the time. She could remember his kisses, which tasted of chewing gum. Nathan had begun to reminisce about his culture shock on moving to the Midwest, about the food, the flat terrain, about his misery. "In all fairness, though, I was unhappy at the college, and that colored everything. From the day I arrived, I was trying to leave. But it's also true that I didn't find anything physically appealing, except Mary." His head made a kind of bow to her across the table, and then he turned to Delia again. "But my heart never leapt to the countryside, or to the town, either." "Well, of course, New England is prettier," Mary said, "greener, curvier somehow. Perfect, really." She looked from one of them to the other. "I've never lived in as perfect a place," she said. "I can't get used to it. I feel, in a way, unsuited to it. It's almost not real to me." She was struck by her own words. She hadn't clearly framed the thought before, but now she did. She didn't feel at home here. "What do you mean, not real?" Delia asked. "Oh, I don't know." She couldn't tell them what she felt, could she? That she didn't feel at home? "Okay," she said. "Okay, for instance, what you call downtown here is so arranged, too prettily arranged. To a Midwesterner, it seems not real, like a stage set." She looked from one of their attentive, polite faces to the other. "Whenever I walk down Main Street, I half expect a chorus of locals to step forward and start singing some happy civic song." She opened her arms wide, a Broadway gesture. This made Delia laugh, and Mary felt such a sense of pleasure that she was almost embarrassed for herself. She got up and began to carry plates into the kitchen. When she came back with a salad, Delia was talking. "The kind of thing a woman of my generation would do, isn't it?" she was saying. "Still, I love it. We have her letters on display in the house, and I love looking at them, the very letters she sat down and wrote to him more than 150 years ago. She looked up at Mary. "I'm telling Nathan about the Apthorpe house. Have you heard of it?" Mary was standing by her, holding the salad bowl so Delia could serve herself. She shook her head. "I haven't, no. I was explaining that I work there, volunteer there, actually." And Delia went on explaining it, about Anne Apthorpe's fiction and how it was discovered, about the house and her involvement in its development as a museum. Mary had sat down opposite Delia now and was watching her. "You lost all sense of her age when she was animated," Mary thought. Of course, the candlelight helped too. Delia's eyes, usually so piercing, seemed softer, gentler in the yellow light. Her wild white hair was an aureole around her face. "I suppose I'm drawn to her because her life was like mine in some ways, though of course she did something so different with it. But basically, she's someone who stayed at home. She had to stay at home, given the times she lived in and her marital status." She had a sip of wine and set her glass down, turned it slowly. "Still, she found a way out, didn't she?" Delia was looking into the flames of the candle in front of her place. Then she looked up at Mary and Nathan and smiled. "Well, isn't that what marriage is all about?" she said. She lifted her hand. "Staying in it, while getting out in some way, too?" "Oh," Mary thought, a window opening inside her. Delia was frowning. After a pause, she said, "But there's part of me, I suppose, that more or less regrets the whole Apthorpe House thing, too." Nathan asked her what she meant. "Well, it's perverse, after all, don't you think, to take a life that was so private, so turned inward, and make it a public life after the fact?" She appealed to each of them, turning from one to the other. "No," Nathan's voice was absolute. He shook his head. "Nope, I can't afford to agree with that. That's precisely how the study of history happens, and I'm an historian." "Oh, yes, I know that, but some lives are meant to be public. My husband's, for instance. He can expect no mercy." She pushed her hair back off her face. "Though, of course, he's not been in office for so long. People ignore him more than they used to." She smiled. "This is still painful for him. After all these years," she said. "Tom again." Mary and Nathan were assiduously not looking at each other. "When was it that he left office?" Nathan asked. "He decided not to run again in 78. And that was because, oh, all kinds of things." Her hand fluttered in the air. "The point I'm making, I think, is that I spend my days passing on information about the life of someone who had every right to expect that her letters might have been of interest only to the person to whom they were addressed. And yet here I am, here is the whole Apthorpe House enterprise, arranging for people to just poke through everything to find out all they can." "But she was a writer," Nathan said, "a person who wanted her work anyway to be made public. Isn't that the bargain such a person makes?" "Oh, no, no." Mary was noticing that Delia used her hands almost constantly. "She struck no such bargain. We've no record that she ever tried to publish anything. And the novel was never even finished, so it truly wasn't a public life, not in any way. It was a domestic life. It just happened to have some writing appended to it, more or less." "Still, I think she's fair game," Nathan said. "History's about private people, too, about individuals, about the self. Maybe you'd call it the soul and the impress on it of what happens out there. Social change, political change, change in cultures in the world." He sat up straighter. He was on, his face alive. "We have to look at what you call private people. What politics means, how life in a moment under certain conditions is felt, is taken in." His hands curved in, touched his own chest, his heart. "So we need, really have a need, to find out about people like your Anne Apthorpe." He frowned. "What I mean, really, is that someone who recorded her feelings, who can explain them to us across these years, even fictionally, is a resource for everyone else like me, anyway." His hand rose to his hair. "Otherwise, we'd just be talking in numbers in the abstract, about governments and wars and economics, and not about how they affected people, which is what makes it really interesting." This was Nathan's whole argument with the political science department in Coleman. They were numbers guys, trends guys. They hadn't much liked his work, and he hadn't liked theirs. Delia nodded slowly 4 or 5 times. "Well," she said, "I can see that. Of course you're right. I hate to agree about my Anne, but I can see that." She seemed to be thinking about it. Then she lifted her chin. "But I don't know. It's all Oedipal in the end, isn't it?" Her face suddenly came alive. She leaned forward now, elbows on the table. "Really? Isn't that it? That the study of history is Oedipal at its roots, connected directly to the Oedipus complex?" "I'm game." Nathan had sat back in his chair, and he was smiling in delight at Delia. "I'll bite. But how exactly would that work?" "Oh," her hand waved, "doesn't it all start, our interest in the past, with our wanting to know more about our own parents? Really, that's what I mean," she smiled, "that drive we all have to get to the root of their attraction to each other. We always want their story, don't we? It's the first history we're really curious about, and the last one. It haunts us, because it's a history with the most important consequence in the world, us." She turned her hands, palm up. "Us and our story, our history." Her eyes were bright in the candlelight. "So," she said, "how did they meet each other? How could they possibly have come to love each other? And then sex, the biggest mystery of all, how do they do it?" She grinned. "What we'd like is to get right into that bedroom and watch them, the primal scene. And if that's not Oedipal, what is?" Her hands rose dramatically. A silver bracelet on her wrist slid down her arm. Nathan laughed, and Mary did too. Delia was pleased with herself. Her mouth made a smug little priss. She had finished her wine, and Nathan held the bottle up, an offering. She held her glass out. Mary looked at him while he reached across the candles with the wine. Did he agree with her, Mary wondered? Had he ever thought about his parents having sex? Mary pictured his mother, her tidy grayish hair, her round, pretty little girl's face. This dining room table had come from her, and these old Windsor chairs which creaked and complained when you shifted your weight in them. Mary couldn't imagine her moaning in sexual pleasure. Delia was expanding on her idea. Our interest in history starts with the personal, then enlarges to the political, the global. Nathan made a case for the reverse process. They were enjoying the argument. Mary watched Delia. It seemed possible for her, sex, unlike most older people Mary had known. Why? The way she dressed, Mary supposed. Tonight, for instance, in a blue sweater and a straight black skirt, a wide silver necklace at her throat, the bangle on her arm, an outfit a woman half her age might have worn. But no, it was more the way she was, something about her energy, what seemed like her appetite for life. Nathan got up now and cleared the salad plates. He was going to fetch their dessert, one he'd made. Desserts were his specialty. While he was gone, Mary told Delia that when they're recording, sometimes one of his desserts would be all they had for dinner. I can remember sitting at the table in my apartment with him eating a lemon tart directly from the pan, the whole thing. She didn't mention that they were naked, having made love so late and that there seemed no point to fixing the first part of the meal. Tonight, Nathan brought out a flan and dished it up for them. It was cool and slippery, and Mary slid it around in her mouth, savoring it. Delia was impressed. She started to talk about French cooking, about Paris. Paris, where she owned an apartment. "I'm actually going there in just a few weeks." She set her spoon down. "And this reminds me, I've been meaning to ask, would you mind doing a few house-sitting chores, just plant watering the mail, that sort of thing?" Nathan said quickly, "We'd be glad to." Mary looked over at him. She could see that he meant exactly this, that he was made happy by the intimacy implied. "Think about it before you say yes," Delia commanded. "I'll be gone for 2 full months. It's more or less my routine at this point, 2 months in the fall, 2 months in the spring." Mary felt a quick pinch of loss, of disappointment. No more Delia this fall, then. She realized she'd seen this dinner as marking the beginning of something, of her getting to know Delia, of course, but more than that, though she wasn't sure what. That they'd be pals? She didn't know. "It's no trouble at all," she told Delia. She had another spoonful of flan. "You go every year," Nathan said. "Yes, twice a year, every year, with the changing of the seasons." "I'm like a migratory bird," Delia said. "I think of the apartment as waiting for me when I'm not there, my nest, though I rent it out occasionally." Now with her fingers, she drew an elaborate map in the air for Mary and Nathan of where it was in relation to the Seine, to the Luxembourg Gardens. Mary confessed she'd never been to Paris. "Ah," Delia said, her eyes fully on Mary, "how wonderful that you have that great pleasure ahead of you." "What's the French connection?" Nathan asked. "How did you end up there?" "Oh, just one of those moments in life when you say, let me out. I needed a getaway. I had a friend in Washington with contacts in Paris, and I spoke a little French." She held her forefinger and thumb about an inch apart. "So I thought, yes, why not? And the rest, as they say, is history, though not your kind," she said to Nathan. They talked about France, about its charms, about its economic problems, about unemployment and assimilation. Delia described going on an errand into the exurbs, and it was like another universe out there, all these tall, grim projects, and the street life. It could have been a souk in Morocco. "This is interesting," Nathan said, nodding his head. "When you think of the great contempt all those formerly homogeneous European cultures have for us, for the way we've dealt with the issue of race in America," he smiled. "Now we'll get to see how well they do at it, I guess." They'd been sitting at the table for a long time. The candles were short and lumpish with wax. Delia's lipstick was gone. She looked tired. Mary offered coffee or decaf, though she expected to be turned down, and she was. And as she also expected, this signaled the evening's end. Delia pushed her chair back and got up, unbending slowly into a straight line, as if her body were arguing with each vertebra. Mary was suddenly conscious of her age. It must hurt to be that old. They moved with her back into the living room. Mary inhaled deeply. The lilies had started to open, and their smell was thick in the air. Nathan helped Delia into her coat. At the door, she gripped their hands in turn. "Thank you so much, my dear," she said. Oh, no, Mary said. Thank you. Thanks for the flowers and for making us feel so welcome. Not at all, Delia said. If I have, I'm glad. I wanted to. She turned to go, then stopped and stepped back. Now, I'll bring the key over tomorrow for when I leave, she said. You should have it anyway. And actually, I suppose I should have told you, I already have yours from Ilona's day. I hope that's something you're comfortable with. They both made assenting noises. And I'll leave the Paris phone number on the pad on the telephone stand, plus the children's numbers, there are three of them, ranked in order of who should be called first, second, and third, in case something happens at the house and you can't reach me. But not to worry, she said. She turned away again and was gripping the doorknob. Nothing happens in October and November. When does something happen, Mary asked, thinking mostly of their house, of what they should be expecting. September, rain, Delia pronounced as she stepped outside. Weep holes clogging up, leaks, and then winter, ice dams making problems, pipes freezing. After they said goodnight, after the door had closed behind Delia, Mary turned to Nathan. Okay, what are ice dams? What are weep holes? Nathan knew, of course. Even though he'd never owned a house before, he explained them to her. How do you always know that stuff? She asked. Are you kidding? Everyone knows that stuff. He went back to the kitchen to start cleaning up. Mary crossed to the lilies. Bending over them, she breathed in their sweet, almost sexual odor. When she went to the kitchen, Nathan reached to her face. For a moment, she thought, in love, but no. He was wiping at her nose and cheek with his thumbs. Lily dust, he explained. They worked together silently. Mary went back and forth to the dining room, clearing the table. On one of her trips into the kitchen, she said to Nathan, I used to steal from the motel. What motel? My first job at the motel. I was an embezzler. He looked over at her, weighing it. She met his gaze. She was interested to see if he'd believe her. Come on, Mary, you did not. Nah, she said, smiling at him. Just joking, she said, and left the room again. She had told Nathan many lies at various stages in their relationship, most of which she'd owned up to. She told him when she first met him that her parents had died in an auto accident when she was 14. Why? She didn't know. She told him that she'd danced topless in a bar. She was trying to turn him on that time. But this was not a lie. The manager at the motel liked the way she looked. He used to hang around after she'd arrived. He'd corner her in the back office. He'd press against her and kiss her sloppily. This was the worst part of the job, and she thought she ought to get paid for it. She knew that he knew what she was doing, but she knew, too, that if she kept the amount small enough, he wouldn't report her. Nathan had never made such a bargain. It went without saying. This next passage is Delia in Paris. This is her spring trip, not the fall one that she'd taken. Is this Mrs. Naughton? The voice at the other end of the line was female, distinctly American, older. Delia had just come in. She was standing at the desk in the entryway to her apartment in Paris. It was raining out, and she was damp. She hadn't had time to change her clothes. It is, she said. Ah, this is, well, you don't know me, but I'm a friend of Tom's, of your husband. I'm Alison Miller. Delia didn't know the name. Her throat seemed to have dried up. She heard her voice as a croak. Yes? It's about Tom. I'm afraid, and then she said in a rush, oh, he's alive. I'm so sorry. I should have started with that. He's alive. Delia sat down hard, so hard that she nearly dropped the phone. But he's had a stroke, the woman was saying, this Allison person. He's here, in Washington, in the hospital. Delia was supposed to talk. She was supposed to say something. But he is all right. Well, no, he's in intensive care. They don't know, I guess. I guess no one seems to know if he's all right. It seems that it's not easy to tell right away how bad these things are. He's had a stroke. It was as though Delia's brain was catching up, half a minute behind what this woman was saying. Yes, they're doing all they can, but they can't say yet how he'll be. But is he conscious? She was seeing Tom, or she was trying to see him, and this seemed important to her, to know this, as a way of imagining what had happened to him. Sort of. He seems almost not conscious. Perhaps, I don't know, he's in a kind of shock. Her voice rose at the end of the sentence. When Delia didn't say anything, she said again, I don't know. Delia was too confused for the moment to respond. She could hear the drumming of the rain on the balcony, the hum of the refrigerator from her kitchen. Her umbrella was dripping slowly onto the floor next to her in the foyer. She'd need to wipe that up. After a few seconds, Allison Miller's voice continued, they think, too, that someone needs to be here who can, someone from the family with the power to make decisions. Well, yes, one of the children would, do the children know? No, I just thought to call you. Delia cleared her throat. I'm sorry, she said, would you tell me your name once more? I'm Allison Miller, I'm a friend of Tom's. And you took him to the hospital? I called the ambulance, yes, and came in with him. Delia was beginning to make sense, a kind of sense of all this, though she wasn't certain what was being asked of her. Do you know, I mean, had Tom made any arrangement in case of such an event? Arrangement? Now Allison Miller sounded confused. Yes, what? Allison Miller's voice was dry suddenly. I think the arrangement, as you put it, was immortality. Delia was silent. And now the woman said more gently, there was no arrangement as far as I can tell. There was a silence. Mrs. Naughton, she said, you need to come home. Home? You need to come to Washington. Tom needs you. But Tom and I, we're not, I know that, I know, but there is no one else. But are you? The rulelessness of her life with Tom had left her unable to be certain of anything in this moment. No, she said, no, not me. And then she said again, there's no one else. Delia had to buy a first-class ticket, the only space available on the next morning's flight out. She was seated next to someone famous, someone whose face she knew very well, but couldn't place. He drank three glasses of champagne quickly, and once the plane was in the air, put a mask over his eyes, tilted his seat back, and went to sleep. After a while, he began to snore in what Delia thought of as a feminine way, little fluttery spurts, as though each breath were a great surprise to him, something to exclaim over. Gasps of snoring, nothing like the steady, deep rasps Tom produced. Sleep wasn't possible for Delia, although to her surprise she'd slept well last night. And now sitting on the plane, she remembered that she had a dream. She'd dreamed of Tom. She began retrieving it bit by bit. An odd dream. Well, weren't they all? She was with him in a clearing in a wood, a kind of glade. She saw it suddenly. It had been like a scene from Bergman, struck with a kind of holy celluloid light, the way his dream sequences often were, full of yearning and nostalgia. She couldn't have said what she and Tom were doing there, but when she'd waked, it was with a feeling of joy. Within seconds, though, lying in her dark bedroom, listening to the rain outside, she remembered the reality. That he was ruined, he was dying. Or not, she didn't know. That was the problem, wasn't it? Immediately after she got off the phone with Allison Miller, she'd called the doctor, a man named Ballantyne, whose number Allison Miller had given her. She'd had to wait a long time while he was paged. Twice someone clicked onto the phone to ask if he could call her back, but Delia said no, she'd hold. When he finally came on the line, he was noncommittal. For now, it was better not to speculate. The next few days, he said, will tell the tale. This phrase struck Delia. It seemed so old-fashioned and familiar. It was something her mother had said to her, something she herself had said occasionally to one of the children when she didn't know how to answer a question. After Delia had hung up, she sat for a long time in the hallway in her wet shoes. It was too much to take in. The woman, a friend, a lover. Tom in some kind of limbo where no one could tell how he would be, who he would be when he emerged. She'd called the hospital again this morning before she left for the airport, but it was still night in Washington, and there was no further news. The nurse or receptionist answering the phone had sounded irritated with her, as though she should have known better than to call, asking for information at such an hour. She spoke to Delia as you would speak to a child, and in response, Delia had felt like a child too, shamed, but angry. She'd calmed herself by carefully setting the table on the balcony for her usual breakfast. She'd had to wipe the table and chair dry with a towel. Then she brought out a tray with the croissant, the seedless raspberry jam, the rich dark coffee with steamed milk. She sat down and laid her napkin across her lap. The consolation of the daily, she thought. There were children playing in the courtyard below, their shrill voices rising. The sky was a pale blue above her, with smears of thin high clouds moving fast across it. She was aware of actually enjoying the musical ticking of the spoon stirring the little lump of brown sugar into her coffee, the sound of the china cup clinking lightly against its saucer as she set it down. That world, so fresh, so perfect, washed so clean by the rain, seemed unconnected to this one, this plane with its stale air, with this person sleeping next to her. And this world, in turn, seemed not possibly to be leading to the one she would arrive in later today, to Tom, lying damaged in a bed in a hospital, to the hospital itself and its terrible life, the routines, the boredom, the anxiety, to the questions she would be in charge of finding the answers to. Tom, whose face stayed blank when she tried to think of him as he might be now. She could only remember him in motion, talking, laughing. Oh, in the dream, Delia's lips parted thinking of it. They'd been practicing cartwheels. How silly. But she remembered the sensation of it, the wild physical abandon of throwing yourself forward in space, of flipping upside down, as wild as sex, really. She remembered, too, that it was understood between them that they had come to the woods to do this in private, so that they wouldn't embarrass the children who didn't know they had this skill, who wouldn't have liked seeing them do it in any case. She leaned forward to look out the window at the cottony fields of sunstruck clouds below her. Thank you.